I want to introduce Gerhard and Thomas, who work in a field that, when I saw the talk, I got wide eyes and said, this is my alley, this is awesome. The combination of optics, of lasers, signal analysis, signal handling, high bandwidth, you name it all, everything that fills up a heart, they're going to talk about. They do in their professional life. I guess when you look at him, at Thomas, you see the name FlexOptics. They know what they're talking about. They know what they're doing. And they do this optical data transfer thingy over fiber for quite some time and are quite innovative for many years. So I hope you are looking forward to the talk as I am. And so please welcome Thomas and Gerhard.
Thank you very much, Sarah, for the very warm welcome here in the ZKM here in Karlsruhe. It's really a pleasure being here. As Sarah already mentioned, my name is Thomas Weible, co-founder and CTO at FlexOptics, a company which is specialized in optical components, especially transceivers, which is an artificial world combination of transmit and receive. You get a transceiver. And we brought a topic today where we think it's going to be a game changer in optical transmission in the next couple of years. And we want to show it to you now. So where we are coming from, the current situation is when we talk in terms of speed, 100 gigabit is currently commodity in the optical network. Broadly installed base and the latest technology is 400 gig, 800 gig, and we are also talking about 1.6 tera already. Now, when you look at the ecosystem about 100 gigabit, there are some limitations, and it comes all back to those tiny pluggables, which you might have seen. Some people identify them sometimes as USB sticks, especially when you're at the airport at security check. This is the easiest explanation to pass through when they are asking and questioning, hey, what is this? It's a USB stick, that's quite easy. But they are actually, form factors, and I showed a couple of them, which are all well known or should be known from the 100 gigabit world. And the 100 gigabit had some drawbacks and some limitations. So some of you might are familiar with those components. With the CFP, it was a big plate, big-ish pluggable module. It had some really nice benefits to take a lot of power out of your switch gear, but it also had a huge drawback. It was huge in terms of port density. And then when those modules were developed further and further, a couple of generations were done, CFP2, CFP4, but for example, CFP4 got a really nice form factor, nice shape and dimensions, but actually didn't get a huge installation base. So when we are talking to customers in the network field who build the internet and build their networks and looking at an audience like this year, there would only be one or two people raise their hand saying, hey, I have a CFP4 in production, and the rest of the 99% don't use it at all or even haven't heard about it. Then there was a company called Cisco. They did some proprietary stuff called the CPEC, but then they also stopped working on that. And finally, there is the QSP28, and that's something which is known since for a while now. It's a really nice form factor. It has a nice management interface. This is also important when it comes to development. It has a nice only 100 pages specification and easy to develop there. But it has one design issue. It can only draw up to 5 watts of power out of the switch or the routing gear. And this is becoming a limitation when we're going to higher speeds and techniques, which we're going to show later on in that talk. This talk is split up in two parts, in the theory part and also in a practical examination, what we did or practical experience we did together with DKIX in Frankfurt. I'm sure it's well known here as the biggest internet hub in Europe, or depending on the figures, how you compare them around the globe. QSFP28 is pretty nice. But it was focused for inner data center links, and so reach up to 10 kilometers. There were some ideas and also techniques done to go up to 30, 40 kilometers. But the technology we are talking about now, about coherent, is 80 kilometers and plus, and that's actually needed to have high bandwidth transmission, not within only a city, but also beyond borders, interconnect cities, for example. So when you look at this coherent stuff, this is nothing new, which is now introduced with 400 gig. So it has been around for a long time, especially also for 100 gig. And when you look on the left side, you see there a transponder card. That's actually the schematics of a transponder card, and there's a huge buck on it, or a chip, the DSP, the digital signal processor. And due to the production facilities in the past of microchip production, they were produced in structures of 28 nanometers, and they were big. And so they were not able to put those module, those chips on a nice form factor. Now with the, and then you end up with a big transponder card doing 100 gig, for example, in DWDM technology, which is mainly used for the long haul transmission stuff. Now, with the latest technologies made in chip production, going down to structures of 7 nanometers or even now 5 nanometers, it is possible now to get a nice, tiny digital signal processor handling 400 gigabit and beyond on a really nice footprint, and also a small amount of power which is pulling out of the module. And you can place it on a QSFP DD, which is a form factor designed for 400 gig and also 800 gig later on, and is capable to handle a load of roughly 20 watts. Okay. This is more to the introduction for the industry perspective, where we are coming from. And I will hand over now to Gerhard. He's doing more the theory part when it comes now to the coherent part.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Welcome.
All right. As Thomas mentioned, thank you very much for handing me over the word. A little bit of boring theory done with a lot of more excitement. That is a must. But we have to run it through in order to explain the basics of coherent transceivers. Let's get back to the typical transceivers we already use. And what we are seeing here is usually the signal we want to transfer, which is digital, which is where we as human beings fight against the nature, because when we start measuring our electrical signal, optical signal, we end up seeing something more like that, because you don't have these kind of jumps, these are ideal. Now the thing is, when you start keying signals like those, and you want to increase the frequency, why do you want to do that? Because you want to have higher bandwidth, you want to be faster, 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 so you increase the frequency. That is one dimension you can go. What happens is, it becomes more difficult in your meshing window to really detect the signal. Now you could say, well, where's my one, where's my zero, right? When I'm transferring the signal, so I want to transfer 10, 10, 10, 10. I need to put a different margin. I'm not looking at -1 anymore, I'm looking at zero. And if I start making the signal even denser, what I get is even a smaller margin, harder to detect. And that is a challenge we have with light and direct detection, with a typical laser and with a typical photodiode, and that is a problem. But with our transceivers, what we are seeing is also a missed opportunity, because you can do more with light. Just measuring the amplitude, you also have different kind of frequencies, but there are more properties to look forward for, and that is what makes coherent transceivers special. And let's start with one property, because it is easy to get this one out of our way, basically. Dimensionality up. polarization. So you have seen it. I mean, you have, I could imagine, or most of you, who has a protective screen on the notebook? Like, you know, it really depends from what point of view you're looking at your screen. Either you see the content or you don't see it. The light is being filtered. So with the coherent transceiver, it's the same principle, but the other way around. You build up a laser where you combine different waves over different dimensions. And since you have your fiber, I mean, we are living in a three-dimensional world, the C-axis, the axis through the fiber, is basically time. C-axis, but you have two dimensions. You can look from the side on it, but you can also have a top view on it. So two different signals you just mix together, you throw it into a blender, and what you end up getting are two planes that per carrier are transferred. So that is one of the properties we are talking. It's polarization, and this is a typical coherent signal. I have not yet talked about the second property phase. It's already included here. And we are now looking at the y-plane, depending how you define it. Let's define that the y-plane is here, and when we rotate it, that is the x-plane. And when we rotate it, like, it is a volumetric signal we are seeing here, right? Now I have rotated to the x-axis, and the signal looks way different. Yeah, you would expect sinus waves here, maybe a little bit, but there are also some uncertainties here. That is due to the phase. We get to this in a couple of minutes. But basically, what you really have with a coherent transceiver is signals that looks more like this. And I find it quite impressive. This is a message of 160 bytes we are transferring, nanoseconds, so very short. It's just a simulation we performed in MATLAB. And basically, that is the kind of signal you're shooting with your laser. And on the other side, with your system of photodiodes and local oscillator, you have to scramble, right? So more properties. More symbols per second, more bits you can transfer per carrier, but that is a challenge. But that is also the task of a DSP that is much smarter and detecting certain pattern can say, oh, this is the kind of data I have, right? So before I talk about phase, I already showed you the diagram of time-based signals. Very simple, 1/0, 1/0, with the rectangle signal. Now we can have a different view, and Constellation can really help us on that. Who has worked with Constellation diagrams? That is a very common in Wi-Fi networks. Wi-Fi have these big 1024 Constellation diagrams. You surely have seen it. So that's a different view. You're not looking at frequency or time. You're really looking at the hotspots. Here's the center, and this is an on-off keying. OOK is on-off keying. So a very simple way to detect signals. Instead of time, we are just looking at the constellation, and in order to get to the phase, we are still in phase, we could use more space in order to transfer more information. So this is the OO key modulation. Now we have PAM4, the pulse amplitude modulation, where you have four levels. You might have seen it when you take an oscilloscope and want to read signals from a transceiver. Those typical eye diagrams, you end up seeing three eyes, basically. So these are the three spaces you see here. And if it's a good eye of a high quality, you really get to see it. If you see a mass and more colors inside in between it, the signal is not as good. So with PAM4, you have different levels. 2^2 means now we are transferring 2 bits instead of 1 per carrier, but we can do even better. And that's another property of the coherent transceivers. Now we are getting to the imaginary part, and the typical one, 16QAM, works like this. The reason for that is we are never on fully on the real component. We always have a combination of imaginary part and real part. Why? Because we have the same distances here. So that is one approach, and it's still simple compared to the modern Wi-Fi 5 or 6 standards, but it is something that coherent transceivers are doing. And what I'm just displaying, I already talked about polarization, that is just one plane. So if you consider polarization, dual polarization, X and Y plane, you have another bit you are adding per carrier, right? So getting back to a more simple time, if you want to compare and understand the meaning of imaginary part and why to describe it as complex and why are you doing the phase shift, who has analyzed the rotary disk? Does anyone know why we have two readers? Any idea? Yeah, tell me. Yes, exactly. Direction is one thing. The second reason is the precision is better. You could also put the reader here on that side and you would have a different pattern, but cutting out the pattern like this is more convenient and you just have two readers. And what you basically end up seeing is I call one reader real part. This is, for my definition, my real part. In the end, it's a mathematical model, and this is imaginary part. And if you imagine that this curve is moving into a certain direction, you can see how the waves arrive. If you inverse the direction, like the colleague explained, you have a different pattern. With that, you can detect direction. So this is for measuring speed, and since these are also lights with photodiodes, it's another way to detect the light and send information. So. Second reader, more information, direction and speed is what you can measure, more information to process. So yeah, we are getting back to the 16 Quam diagram. I draw some circles with amplitude and some angles, and we are going to play a card game. So can you help me on defining the center so the audience knows where we are, basically? Because I have a question to you. And what we are going to measure is, who has heard of bit error rate? Any idea how you calculate this guy?
I'm the center.
Okay, we'll get into this. So what we want to do here is, you as an audience are going to play a coherent transceiver that is sending a signal. And I want you to know if the signal you're sending is correct. So. It's like a guessing game, and these are the signals I want to go through. What I want to know is what point, what spot do we have to hit in order to get 1, 1, 1, 1? And which angle is it, and what amplitude do we have to consider? Does everybody has a card? Please lift your hand. And if you know, if you have the signal, please let me know. Anybody an idea what amplitude you need and what phase in order to get this series of bits?
Here we go.
All right, we have two. Awesome. So I have just transferred 4 bits times 2. I like it.
Which is so we have 33% and 45 degrees.
Yeah, I saw it. Thank you. That looks good. Next one, so 0101. How do we get 0101? Uh-huh. 33 and minus 135. Yep, looking good. So we have transferred eight. Oh, oops, hopla, wrong button. We've transferred those. And last one, 00 and 11. It is around, it's there. Who is it? All right. So try that, try this, and try that. 12, 24.
And, oh. Amp, and it's 162.
One yes?
8 should be a little bit upper. The 108 would be 0110.
Yeah. Wasn't it correct? It was correct, wasn't it?
It was over there, yeah.
But
yes, we got two, we got two two angles in the audience, but we sorted it.
Okay, so we have I didn't see it. We have 75 and 162.
Yes,
correct. Ah, awesome. Yeah, then it's correct. Zero errors. Awesome audience. Thank you very much. Thanks for playing the game. You're amazing. All right. So I already mentioned how to calculate bit error rate. That is one view. As an IT system engineer, I only care for bits. So how many bytes, bits, whatever I'm transferring per second. And this is my measurement for signal quality. But if you ask an electrical engineer or telecommunication, he would also have a look at this value. And obviously, they correlate. So what you want to have is a distance of this signal to your noise. This is the signal noise ratio, and the convenience of using decibels is that you can add them, you can subtract them, you don't have to calculate some fraction here. That is how decibels work. And yeah, what you have when you measure your transceivers is since they translate between electrical and optical signal is electrical SNR and optical SNR. And yeah, that is one way to measure the signal quality, though that margin is very important. And here's an example of different signal noise ratios. So very good quality is 30 dB. You get a constellation diagram from our simulations that looks like this. Obviously, it was with the Rosin-Ramler generation. It's a simulation still, but something you can consider, you can measure. If you start decreasing it, like you still have your grid here and you still can measure it, right? You have distances to your hotspot you want to achieve, but still with your tolerance, that's the reason why we have these distances. It works pretty well. You can still detect your signal even though the SNR decreases, but if you have it at like 5, some of these points might jump over the grid edges and you get a wrong signal and your bit error rate starts to increase. Well, all right, so that's all the theory. I hope it wasn't too boring. We try our best to explain it as well as possible. But now to the exciting stuff. Thomas, you're doing the practical part. Thank you.
Yeah, maybe just going back to those 30 dBs. So you would be like an SNR of 30 dB. So you're really quiet, no noise level at all. So if we would do that talk in a cheering football stadium, we might end up at SNR of 5 dB, for example, just as an analog example. So what we did is, so we used those pluggables together with DKIX, their router equipment. They have quite a lot of equipment there. We plugged it in their interface cards and looked basically with one simple command, the show port command, how the operating system, in this case it was a Nokia gear, the SRS, how it recognized and which mechanisms are used, which we learned now in the theory, when it comes to a practical attempt to troubleshoot and to analyze your links when you build links. And there are basically three sections, and I will go through them now. So the first section is more about the characteristics and the hardware which we have there, the underlying hardware, a typical pluggable transceiver here. It is fully tunable, so we can change the frequency to go through certain filters in the DWDM grid. And so what they implemented there is they show it in megahertz, which is a pretty big number actually. I don't read the full number now, but we typically talk in terahertz when it comes to light. So it's 191.3 terahertz to 196.1 terahertz, or even simpler, channel 13 to channel 61. So we can fully tune it. It's currently tuned to channel 23, and there are a couple of grids which are supported. A well-known and broadly used is 100 gigahertz and 50 gigahertz. It's there are a lot of filters out there in the field already deployed in lower speeds, like for 10 gigabit, for example. Now, the second section is the diagnostic. All those transceivers typically have a diagnostic functionality. There are five values in there, which are interesting to monitor. That's the temperature, for sure, bias current going through the laser, and then TX and RX levels. That's really important to see my light levels actually coming, going out and receiving, and finally the voltage, if everything is working fine. I highlighted the temperature because until the 400 gig, or especially the 400 gig, the temperature was not much to worry about. All the transceivers so far were operating within the spec. For sure, if your entire cabinet goes up to 50 or 60 degrees centigrade and the entire gear is boiling, for sure, then it also influences your equipment, which is typically rated up to 70 degrees. Now, with the coherent one, the temperature is becoming really a critical part, and these are two reasons. First of all, you need to provide a lot of power. So when we look at the figures, the amount of power we feed in there is basically heat. So
what is converted to light level, which is only 0.001 watt, which is roughly not a lot. But in optic world, it is quite a lot. This is 0 dBm power level, which is a lot for the optic world. So the other 16.999 watt are heat dissipated by heat, and we have to get rid of this. So the first one is feeding a lot of power. And then the second one is get rid of all that heat. And when you have a 1U switch doing 32 ports, you can do the math on your own. This is a lot of watts. Some people use this as heater as well in their house if they operate it, and you have to cool it for sure. And we have seen implementations also out there from some system manufacturers that they said, okay, we can't provide that enough power, and we also have a cooling issue, so we can enable a higher power mode on those ports, but then you can only use every second port. So this will end up your 32 port switch is at the end of the 16 port switch, which you can operate there. So this is quite important to know when you operate that gear, how is it capable and how much power it can feed to those modules. And then the third section we identified is all about those coherent parameters, and I will go through them now step by step. So the first one is, which pointed out for us, is the RX channel. Why do I point that out? Typically, when we're talking about a tunable transceiver where we can change the frequency, this is more a laser thing, the TX. So you change the frequency on the laser, and then in your optical network, you do it with optical multiplexers to get it to the right channel on the receiver. Now, for coherent modules, you need to tune the receiver as well, because there is a local oscillator in there also for the receiver side to get rid of the carrier. There are coherent pluggables out there which have two local oscillators, so they have two lasers, one for the receiver, one for the transmitter, which is perfectly fine, and then you can do something like you can transmit on channel 23 and can receive on channel 25, for example, and this is used for single fiber transmission. If you want to have, if you only have one fiber between your links, you can do TX and RX on the same fiber. Now, with those QSFP DDs, there is currently only one laser involved, and there is an optical splitter inside, so then the RX channel is always the same like the TX channel. But you still have to configure it, because the operating system doesn't know about this characteristic and doesn't do any checks there. The next one is about chromatic dispersion, or in general dispersion. We are talking about two dispersion things here. So what is dispersion in general? This is the change of the signal while it's traversing over time on your fiber. So at the beginning, maybe you have your signal looks like this, and then it's getting dense, for example, while it's traversing over the over time to the receiver side. And we can compensate this with the power of the DSP. Typically, this is the positive one, is the critical one, up to 2,000 picoseconds for a fiber. The great thing is also we can do measurements now with the DSP, and we know the dispersion of the current span. So our current span here, the link had 15 kilometers of fiber, and when you know the characteristic of a fiber, which is standardized, like a G652.D, which is the well-known single-mode fiber used all around the world since 20, 30 years, it has a characteristic of maximum 10 picoseconds per nanometer per kilometer. So if, when you do the reverse mathematics, you will end up with 22 kilometers, actually. You would end up. It was actually 15 kilometers only, the span, so you should have a dispersion of 150 picoseconds per nanometer. We couldn't figure out where this offset is coming from. How we figured it out was we used a jumper cable back-to-back, 2 meters, linked two transceivers with each other, and then here we are. We had 70 picoseconds of dispersion, and we don't have an explanation so far where it's coming from. Beside the chromatic dispersion of one polarization direction, what we mentioned at the beginning, we have two polarizations actually. You can also have a difference of the two planes, the X and the Y plane. So while the signal on the X plane is traversing and the signal on the Y plane, they can also differ to each other. They are starting at the same time, but then they run behind each other basically. That's something which can be compensated with the DSP as well to do the math and calculation. This link was running at 2 picoseconds of an offset or delay, and we can do, depending on the specification, we are following up to 10 picoseconds or 20 picoseconds. We can compensate. After that, it's not doing possible anymore. And finally, there is a very interesting thing within the DSP is the forward error correction. So we are able to correct errors which happened, and they happened actually, while we are on the line or when we received the bitstream. We can correct those errors, and the important value for us is the prefec bit error rate. So how many bit errors do we have before we before we enter the FEC? And this is in correlation also with the RxQ margin, which is in the optical industry also known as the Q factor. That's actually the amount of space which is still left for the forward error correction still be able to correct errors. So when this margin is eating up down to 0 dB, then the forward error correction cannot correct any errors any longer, and the post-fec value is getting weak. And then the link is ending up with a flapping link, and afterwards the link is down, so no traffic passing on that link any longer. On a back-to-back link with 2 meters of jumper cable, we had roughly 4 dB of margin left for the forward error correction to get to correct errors to work there. And then the SNR, as Gerhard also mentioned, the noise level, signal-to-noise level ratio. For sure, we have 2 polarization directions. Then we also have 2 optical signal-to-noise ratio values. Both were at the same level at 34 dB, which is a really great SNR value there. And the coolest thing, what I personally think, is about those 400 gig transceivers is they are not only a dedicated 400 gig transceiver, so you can change the configuration of the DSP in an application mode, and you can, for example, operate it in a 2x200 gigabit mode or a pure 300 gigabit mode if you want to. What we are currently looking here at is these are 2 specifications which have been precisely talk about specification, not standards. The industry has agreed on a couple of specifications, and there are 2 major ones. The one is called the 400 OIF 400 ZR, and then there is a new one called the Open ZR Plus. And as you can also see, the Open ZR Plus MSA multi-source agreement does give way more freedom in terms of what kind of application modes are possible. Pointing out now the Open ZR Plus, which is actually the compatibility which is shown in our operating system. Actually, when we look on the hardware specs, the module even was not compliant to that mode. So it was an OIF module, 400 gig ZR OIF module, unamped and amplified possible. The operating system does not check it. So that's actually what we said in the CLI and said, hey, you are now an OpenZR Plus. The operating system does not check this, so you have to be really precise knowing your hardware, what you configure there, because otherwise you will end up with different measurement values. And yeah, I don't know the English term for that, but we're missed. That's where you end up, actually. You measure garbage then, and you get wrong thresholds. So looking at those 2 specifications, the interesting part is actually not on the TX and RX power. They specify certain power levels, which is nice when we compare the OIF 400 ZR with the OpenZR Plus MSA 60LA. L is the low power version. They are pretty similar. They differ pretty much in the dispersion values and also in the OSNR. Values. And as you can see, the OpenZR Plus is way more flexible when it comes to long distance transmission when you amplify them as well, because when you compensate up to 20,000 picoseconds, that's 10 times more than roughly 10 times than the 2,400 picoseconds per nanometer on the OIF400ZR, and you need that when you amplify links and you go beyond 100, 200, 400 kilometers, the chromatic dispersion is becoming really serious, and you need to compensate that. An interesting one is the 60HA. The H is the high power version, and these are those 0 dBm output, those 0.001 watts, which we actually generate of light. And with this type of modules, today's networks are really aiming to build networks with 400 gig coherent technology with this type of transceiver, because then they don't need external amplification in their network for a certain distance. All the two others, the 400ZR and the 60LA, to build a proper link beyond a couple of meters and kilometers, depending how much optical components are involved, you need optical amplification, a dedicated device to amplify there anyway, or you need this, but for the HA version, you don't need that. It launches that much power out of the transmitter itself that there is no need to boost up the signal on a certain distance, for sure. If you go beyond a couple of hundred kilometers, then you have to boost the signal again, but out of the box, it can operate there. And this brings us almost to the end. As I said at the beginning, this coherent technology, and especially with the DSP inside of those modules, is more a game changer in optical transmission. And I think this graph shows it quite well, because just with raw compute power, we are able, when we look at the green dot, for example, which is a PAM4 signal, which already encodes 2 bits per symbol, but if you just want to do a jump up to 1.6 terabit, for example, and we change to dual polarization 16 QAM modulation, coherent modulation type, with the DSP, we just did it 4 times more bandwidth or amount of data we add there, and increase the overall bandwidth of that module 4 times more, just with the compute power inside. Looking at the current 800 gig development, there are also techniques to increase the overall frequency, especially on the electric lanes when you feed in the electric signals. So the target is, or we are doing standardization now on 50 gigabaud on the electrical side, and there are attempts also going towards 100 gigabaud, which is a lot of very, very high frequency. This is always a balance between how much effort you put into the DSP development, or if you have a PCB substrate which can handle higher frequencies, there's also efforts made there. And it's, at the end of the day, it's an economic question as well, because you do not only want to produce one part, you want to produce a couple of million parts, and there the figures count. Yeah, brings us to the end of the talk. We really enjoyed it. Thank you very much. We are a pretty easygoing crowd at Flex Optics. We like what we do. We're really passionate on the optical side. And if you want to learn more about what we are doing, just talk to us. We are around this evening. Thank you very much.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. My heart is smiling. Are there any questions?
I have a question about the distortion. Is it maybe the roughness, or is it how it bends or twists or curves, or like the fiber, or any idea where it comes from? Signal. How was it called exactly?
The dispersion.
Chromatic dispersion?
Yes.
Yeah.
I can try.
Sure, go ahead.
So, Okay. With the microphone, please.
So it boils down to physics, but basically your light wave travels through a medium, right? So it has a speed of light in a medium. And the first thing is speed of light depends on the wavelength in that medium. So if you go for higher frequencies, then inherently you get shorter wavelength. They might have a different speed of light. Then you also have this phenomenon where, yeah, let's not go into non-linearities, but so you have a frequency dependent speed of light, so some parts of your signal might overtake the others, and that might wash out the thing. That's basically if you had, like, say, a group of kindergartners starting to race, and some are faster. So in the receiver, you need to, you know, figure out which parts of the kindergartner group belong to each other to reassemble, you know, the message that they were going to convey, and that's where you have a lot of DSP in the equalizer to combat that. I hope that is. I mean, this is the wireless communications real thing, but basically we're doing the same here, right?
Yeah. And I like the kindergarten example. That's pretty cool.
I actually had that in an exam. Like,
okay, yeah, okay.
People hated that exam for some reason. I don't know.
Okay. And there can be all kind of effects on a fiber happening. So some of them go back to the frequency. Some of them definitely go back to the what kind of class or how is it dotted, the class itself. And then there are other effects as well, like when we come to coherent technology, we can also shift the phase, not by purpose, but for example, when there's a lightning strike, it will has an influence and it can do a phase shift. Or even we have seen now people working on, some of you are familiar with an OTDR measurement, optical time detection reflection thing. So you send out a pulse on the fiber and you take the watch clock and at zero when you start shooting it out, and then you look what events are reflecting backwards. A plug is an event. It does like a mirror, but typically we don't want mirrors in an optical network because otherwise there's too much reflection. So far, the OTDR just did a time measurement. You boost, you shoot out a signal, and then you measure when those events are coming backwards, and then you see there's a splice, a broken connector, or whatever. Now, when you do this on a coherent way, you can even see phase shift and all kind of things. You could identify, there's currently a project ongoing, which is not only on an academic purpose, but really on the real world. You use a fiber next to a railroad track, you can identify which train has a rattling wheel while it's passing on that railroad track, because the rattling wheel has an influence on the fiber in the ground, and then you do measurements there and you can really identify, okay, this train now passing by this ICE 171 at this time with that speed has an issue with a wheel. It's pretty amazing. I just saw a couple of weeks ago a presentation about this. They didn't want to tell us exactly how they're going to do it. There's a lot of IP involved to do this, because this is like groundbreaking stuff if you can do measurements like this. What they did is an attempt. They dig the fiber in the ground, a couple of hundred meters. It was below a meter roughly, and they used a bar of wood, placed it on top of it, and used a slash hammer and slashed on that bar, and they were capable and able to measure where the guy was standing with the slash hammer on that fiber, although it was digged 1 meter in the ground. So there are a lot of things which influences the signal, and I hope this explains a little bit.
The beautiful side of chromatic dispersion might be an experiment we all have seen in physics class, the prism, when you shoot light on it and you get to see different colors from that white. Not very useful for us, we don't want that, but it's an example of chromatic dispersion, as you can see it and might observe in fibers.
Okay, thanks for the talk. When I wrote my diploma thesis something like 15 years ago, I wrote about traveling of ultra-short pulses through fibers. And at that time, there was dispersion-compensated fibers were a thing. Is it still the case? Is it still in use? like compensating dispersion of the laser so you can travel longer distances.
Yes, definitely. Until the speed of, let's say, 100 gigabit, people used dispersion compensation modules. It could be a fiber or components, but it's more on a physics level and not on the compute power. Yeah, but yes, they are in place around. Yes.
Hi. I have read about polarization retaining fibers, and I have not really understood what they are for and how they may apply to this application.
I have to look it up as well. Polarization retaining fiber.
Okay.
Polarization retaining fiber.
Sorry.
It's actually quite easy because that's what we said in the very beginning. We have this this more or less cyclic part of the polarization in there, and the polarization maintaining fibers, they got some stress structures which put some tension to the center fiber, which leads to that the polarization can travel from one direction to the other. And so you go in with linear polarization, and it keeps the polarization throughout the whole fiber.
Okay. Thank you.
I think we have a new friend group. Hey, Thomas, thanks for the talk. Maybe a question less with physics, but still some sort of related. We've seen when we moved from 10 gig optics at roughly 1 or 2 watts per transceiver to now 15, 18, 20 watts per transceiver. And if you ever have seen a fully stacked 400 gig switch, it becomes really hot, and my technicians now have to wear gloves to touch those 70 centigrade transceivers. Mm-hmm. Going forward, where do you see this going? Stuffing more complexity into the transceiver and making it even hotter so we can finally burn people really bad? Or where does it go?
Yeah, maybe we should get into the heating industry then. That's a really good question in terms who is taking care about what. There isn't a train or a movement of a couple of vendors and also closed vendors. Like some of you are familiar that Google is doing quite a lot of hardware development, but they don't open it for the public market, so that's their own stuff. There are ideas getting rid of the DSP in the transceiver. This will lower the temperature for sure, and doing more on the ASIC side of the switching. It's called the LPO, linear pluggable optics. So the module is getting dumber again, and the ASIC takes care about, or the chip itself of the switch does more of the coherent stuff. It hasn't been sorted yet, if it's going to be more on the pluggable side or on the switching or routing side. So both is in development. For sure, having the DSP inside of the module will be there for a while. So you better buy some gloves for your engineers and technicians. This helps.
Please, no asbestos.
Cool.
If we have a way to improve our semiconductors so they don't emit more heat, it's the same run we are going for. I mean, in the end, we are producing with different nanometer technologies. I think we showed the transponder card was 28. Now we are down to 5 and 3. But heat dissipation, we also see it in the process. It's the same here. So what you can do regarding thermodynamics, more surface, more area on surface, like heat pipes and all that stuff. But I don't have an answer to that. Google maybe are looking for getting more stuff into the switch, but they face the same challenge. The switch can be bigger, but you also have to cool it down. So yeah, let's buy a couple of gloves.
There is also, but it's still compared to the overall amount and installation base, there are some ideas and also people doing it about immersion cooling. So the challenge there is really to seal the optical components inside of the transceiver, that the liquid, and depending what kind of liquid, if it's oily based or if it's pure water, that it doesn't enter the optical components. There are ideas, but this is not in mass production yet. This is still like, okay, we can do it. And then when you do immersion cooling, then for sure you have higher temperatures, which you can run there as well. And but then you have other issues. You maybe need some gloves as well, but different type of gloves to get it out.
Yeah, and if you dry it out with water, vapor explosion. So maybe better oil, but oil doesn't have that same heat conductive properties. So yeah. Air is pretty much secure on that. You don't have electrocution with air flows.
Yeah, since I have the experts, we are not at 400 gig yet, but we did buy our first 100 gig optics, and I was wondering what I know what the difference between a DWDM and CWDM is. It's coarse and dense wave division multiplex, but could you maybe touch on why you might use one or the other? What the benefits of one are? Or is it?
Yeah, that's CWDM has been around for especially 1 gig and 10 gig networks, and it was cheap to produce. So it was an economic question. When you compare at these days, we're talking about 15 years ago, this were my beginnings at Flex Optics, and CWDM was, available. Compared at this stage with DWDM networks, it was cheap. Now today, the production capabilities are so great, you don't worry about CWDM any longer, and you get really the benefit of the DWDM having at least 40 channels on a big 100 gigahertz grid. And if you go 50 gigahertz or even slice it down, you get on a single pair of fiber, you get up to 69 or even more. 96 channels. So the density is the driver there. So you get way more channels on a fiber on an economic scale. I didn't get that.
I get you the mic.
So if I'm doing a point-to-point link between two switches, it doesn't really matter. It's if I'm multiplexing multiple links onto a fiber.
Correct. Okay. So the rough idea on CWDM is doing typical 16 channels. Yes, there are also networks doing more than 16 channels, these are the typical 16 CWDM channels, and only on a certain distance as well. So roughly saying 60 kilometers and not longer. To amplify it, yes, it's doable, but it's not no mainstream technology there. And on DWDM, the great thing is a lot of channels, you can boost it up of a couple of thousand kilometers if you want to, and if you need to, it's way more easier to handle than compared with the costs you have to bear now, totally fine.
I think we have time for a short question. Regarding your precise and good answers.
I think here.
Thanks for the talk. What's the impact of coherency on the power efficiency regarding transmission?
In general, there is a more general answer on the coherency. I would explain it another way. When you look in today's world now about power savings, everyone is aiming on power saving, but not in the internet. So the switches are getting smaller and smaller. You want to put more switches per rack. You generate way more heat heat on a rack. So 5 kilowatt per rack is the low end today. People talking about 40, 50, 100 kilowatts per rack. And the same happens on the transceiver side. So there is no power saving. There is feed in as much power you can, build traces which can handle a couple of amps, and that you reach that goal, that you do 400, 800, whatever? There is a follow-up question.
So I was asking because like burning the engineer's hands is not a problem as long as the fiber works, but there's temperature limits on the fiber as well. So regarding the question, if you cram more and more transceivers into one switch, at some point you have like heat density issues.
Okay, you mean on the fiber, okay. Yeah. Okay, yeah, can happen, but not on the scale where we are doing optical network. I think when you talk to submarine cable, people cable operator who operate a submarine cable, they are having way higher laser classes boosting in there, but not on the level where we are for the moment.
I might have a question.
Sure.
Coming from the class 4 laser world and temperature and stuff like this, so I had a 50-watt laser, fiber laser on my desk and tinkering with it. Heat and wavelength and detuning and stuff, is this something relevant?
Yes, it is. It is definitely. So a big challenge there as well is to keep the temperature stable with tech cooler, for example, that the wavelength isn't drifting too much. So yes, we use active cooling technology there for the lasers to keep them stabilized. Also for those tiny ones.
Yeah,
not only for the big ones.
I think this is gives quite some headaches.
Yeah.
Well, three minutes.
You showed pages and pages of configuration options. How much is this manual artisanal tuning of each specific fiber optic cable, or how much can they, like, you use default settings again, or there's an auto-tuning options, or can they fall back to worse protocols if the link, if the signal-to-noise ratio gets bad? How much is manual, how much is automatic?
Currently, a lot of things are manual. And also those application modes I showed, this is like the full set, which is doable, but the software is still lacking of it to do it. So the hardware is capable to do it. Like in every hardware development, the hardware has a broad set of this. And when you talk to the soft workers, you only had implemented for the first release something like this. And yes, you're adding more and more functionality. So this is one big thing now in the optical world and those pluggable modules to do a firmware update, which is very well known for all kind of computers. But now you do this on a tiny USB stick to a firmware upgrade. Yep.
Wonderful. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having us.
Interesting talk on this wonderful topic. I enjoyed it very much. I hope you enjoyed it as well. GPMM.